A very good Monday. Welcome to today's edition of the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In addition to feature agricultural news reports, I'll bring you national and regional agricultural news headlines. And I'll start with regional ag news right after this.
AgroPlante is the leading manufacturer in specialty products. AgroPlante formulates products that rise to the challenge of today's growing conditions. Saline and sodic soils reduce crop yield and cause significant crop losses. AgroPlante developed Cation EX5 Plus with growers in mind to manage soil salinity. With multiple years of research, Cation EX5 Plus has proven to be an excellent source of calcium and an effective soil salinity manager. Run it through drip irrigation without any issues. Simplify your application method with innovative and efficient formulations. Alleviate salinity stress with Cation EX5 Plus. AgroPlante, imagination, innovation, science in action.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture is now accepting applications for its Water Efficiency Technical Assistance Program. The 2021 state budget appropriated $15 million for the WETA program, which funds irrigation, water efficiency, and nutrient management technical assistance grants. The grant program is designed to facilitate technical assistance to agriculture operations for on-farm water and energy use efficiency and nutrient management. Through this solicitation, CDFA will award up to $14.25 million to eligible organizations to provide technical assistance to farmers and ranchers through one or more of the program's three objectives. The first objective is provide on-farm irrigation system evaluations. The second objective, coordinator provide pump efficiency testing. And the third, providing training on water use efficiency and nutrient management practices and technology. Resource Conservation Districts, University of California, and California State University campuses, California community colleges, nonprofits, and federally and California recognized Native American tribes are eligible to apply for up to $500,000 for a maximum grant term of 3 years. Applications will be accepted in a competitive grant application process. Applications are due by June 6th at 5 p.m. Growers in Tulare County normally enjoy harvest and fragrant orange blossoms this time of year, but last month's flooding requires an extensive cleanup operation and is a major challenge for the state's top citrus-growing region. The county produces California's largest share of navel and Valencia oranges and mandarins. Now farmers are dealing with standing water in groves, mucky sediment, and driftwood strewn across their ranches. More than 60% of the citrus crop has been picked, but the wet weather has resulted in export windows being missed. Having more water this year has not necessarily boosted state plantings of field crops. Of crops tracked by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, only three, corn, rice, and dry beans, are projected to increase in acreage. Rice in particular is expected to make a major comeback. Last year, the Sacramento Valley rice region fallowed vast acreage. This year, California's rice plantings are expected to reach 404,000 acres compared to 256,000 acres in 2022. A U.S. District Court for the District of North Dakota has granted a preliminary injunction stopping the Biden administration's Waters of the U.S. rule from taking effect in 24 states. Combined with a previous ruling in the Southern District of Texas, 26 states across the country are now protected from the Biden WOTUS rule. The injunction was granted thanks to a lawsuit filed by 24 state attorneys general seeking to overturn the WOTUS rule. California was not among the states seeking a WOTUS injunction. Thanks to a recent vote by the San Diego County Supervisors, the Ag Pass allows for farmers to return home to care for livestock in the event of a mandatory evacuation due to a disaster such as wildfire or an earthquake. Disasters and wildfires threaten lives and businesses in San Diego County each year, according to the county. Often people are forced to gather up their most important possessions and evacuate to safety. But commercial livestock operations may be too large to evacuate all their animals immediately and need to return as quickly as possible to care for the animals. The Ag Pass also allows for farmers to return to care for crops, irrigation systems, farm equipment, and other essential infrastructure. While the Ag Pass will allow farmers and farm operators to return to their farms while a mandatory evacuation is ongoing, they are still required to evacuate when mandatory evacuation orders are given. According to the county, the Ag Pass access is limited to daylight hours and does not guarantee entry into the evacuated area. The pilot program started last year and was limited to cattle and equine operations, but with the recent approval by the county supervisors, the program is now offering access to more than 4,000 commercial agriculture and livestock operators in the unincorporated area, according to the county. Farmers and operators can apply for the Ag Pass program to return to an evacuated area to help when a threat diminishes by going to the San Diego County website. Morro Bay residents will soon have a closer look at state and federal legislation involving offshore wind energy developments thanks to new changes to city policy. The City Council has adopted resolutions that will allow for the notification of any policy changes or proposals taking place at the local, state, and federal meetings. The goal of the resolutions is to make sure that the powers that be understand they want a seat at the table and be a part of the process of what might affect the city of Morro Bay, according to Mayor Carla Wixom. Wixom, who serves as the head of the Morro Bay Subcommittee on Offshore Wind Energy, has handled the city's involvement with energy companies since December of 2022, when the U.S. Bureau of Offshore Energy Management held a sale for commercial wind farm leases in the Pacific Ocean. And the city's involvement, she says, hasn't really been established thus far, at least by some of the energy companies. The effects of the city itself could potentially be non-existent or at least very minimal, as Morro Bay does not have the deep water required for effective wind farms in the bay itself, according to Wixom. But that isn't to say the city would not be impacted by the infrastructure required to run wind farms outside of the city. The Offshore Wind Coastal Protection Act, Assembly Bill 80, authored by Assemblymember Don Adidas, a Democrat from Morro Bay, is one of the bills currently moving through the state legislature. It would create the Offshore Wind Coastal Compensation Fund to mitigate the effects that potential wind farm developments could have on the Pacific Ocean's ecosystem and local economies. Another bill, AB 525, signed into effect by Governor Gavin Newsom in September of 2021, requires the California Energy Commission to develop plans for development of wind energy off the California coast in federal waters. That planning could impact Morro Bay with its inclusion of recommendations to update ports, upgrades to and investments in transmission to ensure delivery of wind farm energy and permitting an environmental impact on coastal resources. However, along with the potential commerce that such laws could bring, there does bring some controversy, as several citizens at previous city council meetings have voiced concern that Morro Bay involvement with the offshore winds could turn the city into an industrial harbor.
Phosphorus is a critical nutrient for almond trees, and in recent years, some growers have questioned whether additional applications need to be made to their trees besides what is already present in the soil. UCCE Orchard Systems Advisor Phoebe Gordon has fielded some of these calls and noted on the Growing the Valley podcast that it's rare additional phosphorus applications are actually needed in orchards.
Part of the reason why phosphorus has kind of been ignored when it comes to plant nutrition research is because way back in the day when scientists were doing, you know, really basic research, when we really didn't fully understand how important added fertilizers could be to getting high and sustained yields, is that when they did phosphorus fertilization trials, they didn't see yield responses usually. And so it's generally been regarded to be a nutrient that just doesn't need to be supplied to plants. I also should add that when we are looking at our soil analysis and it gives a phosphorus value and it gives, you know, low, medium, high, and very high, that's actually not really an accurate measure of what is in the soil. It's a measure of what's available to be taken up by the plant, and the responses are actually based more off of how likely it is that added phosphorus is going to result in a growth response. So if you have something like very high levels of phosphorus in your soil, that means that if you're growing some of our traditional row crop plants, there's actually very little likelihood that your plants are going to grow more if you add phosphorus.
To make the situation even more complicated, Gordon said research hasn't been able to present definitive guidelines for tree phosphorus levels.
When I was doing the literature review for this, after we saw, you know, results and were writing up the results for peer review publication, you know, I came across this value that was cited in a paper from California Research that 5 parts per million of phosphorus in the Olson bicarb test was sufficient for trees but there was not actually a citation that backed that up. And so I can't really say if it's accurate or not. So I guess that kind of sets the background and why I would always say that, you know, trees don't need phosphorus, don't bother adding it. I've never seen low leaf tissue values. I do kind of want to add an asterisk to the leaf tissue values for phosphorus. I don't know if those are super vigorous or can be very strongly defended, because I don't know if those values were based off of phosphorus research. And I think conversations with Patrick Brown, who is kind of our nutrition, plant nutrition professor up at UC Davis, I kind of got the sense that those are probably based off of, you know, really vigorously growing trees, maybe pulled from other values or from other research, and where they basically saw no symptoms of phosphorus deficiency. But I'm not saying that those values are completely junk. You know, if you have leaf tissue values that show that your trees are low in phosphorus, you should definitely add it. But, you know, because it's really hard to determine a leaf critical value if you can't set up an experiment where you do, you know, like low, medium, and high phosphorus fertilization levels, you get a yield response, and then you do your leaf tissue value based off of that.
Further research into anaerobic soil disinfestation with USDA ARS researcher Greg Brown prompted Gordon to look into phosphorus and nitrogen fertilization in young almond trees, and she said the results were surprising.
We found basically as long as you added nitrogen or phosphorus, the trees had a positive growth response. And we were pretty surprised to see that just adding one or the other seemed to provide a benefit. And we didn't really see any additive or multiplicative effect when we looked at the complete fertilizers. And so we came back and measured it after 1 year. We came back and measured it after 2 years, and the results held true. Adding something that wasn't just a micronutrient mix benefited the trees. And so I will say that we were measuring what's called trunk cross-sectional area. So it's basically like if you cut the tree off and you measure the area of the trunk, the surface area of that stump, that's trunk cross-sectional area. And so at the end of the first year, the results were pretty small, probably about maybe a 15 centimeter increase in trunk cross-sectional area between the control and the numerically largest treatment, which was the phosphorus. But after year two, that increased to about 15 centimeters squared. So I will say we did get, you know, a good increase. We weren't able to measure yield here, but in general, trunk cross-sectional area has been very closely connected to yield. So, you know, we definitely saw an increase in the trees, and it was a positive increase from phosphorus as well as nitrogen. So the other sites that we looked at, we were basically only interested in pursuing phosphorus, at least at the second site. And so what we did there was we just did a little trial where we either was with phosphorus or without. The site was set up in such a way that we could actually look at it across two different somewhat close related soil types. It was Ramona and a San Joaquin series soil. And we basically saw the same thing. Adding phosphorus increased the growth of the trees over 2 years. And so I also say we only added the phosphorus close to planting in year one. And so if we're seeing an effect in year two or year four, it's still from that early fertilization. Something that was interesting at that second site is that the grower had actually added in really high rates of composted chicken manure. I think it was close to 3 tons an acre. And we saw phosphorus results despite that. And we were very surprised by that because manures tend to have fairly high rates of phosphorus. The third trial we set up, third and fourth trials we set up at Kearney. And we were interested in looking at phosphorus where we're actually controlling fumigation. I will say, you know, the first site wasn't fumigated. The second site was, but because we didn't have, with the phosphorus trial, an unfumigated control or a fumigated control, we couldn't say if there was, you know, some sort of connection. And then we were also interested in looking at it in the context of wood chips and whole earth recycling, because both of our grower collaborators independently decided to recycle their orchards. And so we were wondering, you know, maybe is this phosphorus beneficial because it's being tied up by the microbes that are breaking down the wood chips? And so in another trial, we also added in, you know, a controlled whole orchard recycling trial. we also looked at nitrogen and the combination of nitrogen and phosphorus. So for those trials, again, we found if we're just looking at phosphorus, adding phosphorus was beneficial.
To hear more about these trials and phosphorus's impact in Trina orchards, check out the Growing the Valley podcast, hosted by Gordon and fellow farm advisor Luke Milliron at growingthevalleypodcast.com. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
The Biden Environmental Protection Agency is proposing the toughest auto emission rules ever to accelerate the transformation of the U.S. auto industry and possibly just as swiftly curtailing ethanol use in vehicles. The proposal, starting with the 2027 model year, could lead to 3/4 of light-duty vehicles being electric by the year 2032, a major boost from what President Biden told the industry, which was to plan for 50% of EVs by the year 2030. Renewable Fuels Association head Jeff Cooper accuses the Biden EPA of picking winners and losers.
It does it through the assumption that EVs are carbon-free vehicles, and everything else, any vehicle with an internal combustion engine, they are assuming that there's a fair amount of tailpipe emissions coming out the tailpipe for those vehicles.
Instead, Cooper argues for a technology-neutral, science-based approach to reducing carbon emissions.
We know that 60% of the electricity produced in this country today still comes from fossil fuels, coal and natural gas, and less than 20% comes from renewable resources. So yes, electric vehicles have a carbon impact, and in many cases, the carbon emissions impact of an electric vehicle is really no better than what you get with a conventional internal combustion engine.
The Washington Post reports the proposals may backfire with the auto industry over the time and cost to build new assembly lines, re-engineer vehicles, make them affordable, and have enough charging stations in place.
The grid is not ready for that. The recharging infrastructure is not anywhere close to being ready for that, and the manufacturers are not ready to produce that volume of electric vehicles. But not only that, are consumers ready, and do consumers want these vehicles?
Cooper says RFA is asking EPA to reconsider its proposal, adding, all they are asking for is a level playing field. The Environmental Protection Agency released its proposed tailpipe emission standards for 2027 and beyond. The Renewable Fuels Association says the agency blatantly tipped these scales in favor of electric battery vehicles. The EPA also overlooked a significant near-term opportunity to achieve significant vehicle efficiency improvements and carbon emissions reductions through increased use of high-octane, low-carbon ethanol fuel blends. They strongly disagree with the policy approaches that arbitrarily pick technology winners and losers with no clear scientific basis, according to RFA President and CEO Jeff Cooper. RFA points out that a flex fuel vehicle running on E85 made from certain forms of ethanol would provide similar or even lower carbon emissions at a far lower cost. The EPA proposal would effectively force automakers to produce more electric battery vehicles and strongly discourage them from pursuing other technologies that could achieve the same or better environmental performance at a lower cost for families, according to Cooper. USDA's April cotton balance sheets for cotton indicated the domestic and global ledgers went opposite directions regarding ending stocks. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
China was the major nation of focus in this month's USDA Global Outlook on Cotton.
We raised China's cotton production forecast by 1 million bales. This is a change that we made for at least a few months in a row now. Mainly it reflects data that we get from China regarding their ginnings and their classings.
That led to increased global cotton production, according to World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski, as well as a rise in ending stocks from the previous month. Turning to the domestic balance sheet.
Relatively strong export pace in recent weeks, so we raised our U.S. cotton export forecast by 200,000 bales.
Contributing to a month-over-month reduction in ending stocks. Meanwhile,
prices have been relatively soft recently. Based on those observed prices, we reduced our cotton season average price forecast by a penny a pound at 82 cents per pound.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Nature's Sweet has filed a third lawsuit against Mastronardi Produce LTD and Mastronardi Produce USA Incorporated. The lawsuit alleges that Mastronardi is mimicking Nature's Sweet's licensed packaging. The company is defending the intellectual property of Cherubs and specifically refers to Mastronardi's Angel Sweet packaging. As alleged in a complaint by Nature's Sweet, Mastronardi made attempts in 2021 and 2012 to mimic Nature's Sweet. In 2022, Mastronardi introduced new packaging for its Angel Sweet. Nature's Sweet is now trying to make Mastronardi stop using its new packaging for its grape tomato product. In response, Mastronardi Produce disputes the allegations that have been brought forward in this matter and will respond accordingly to pursue and protect all of its rights, according to a spokesperson. Megan Schweitzer, USDA economist, has some of the key food price numbers that came out in the latest Consumer Price Index.
Prices for food at home or groceries, those prices declined 0.2% in March. And we're about 8.4% higher than a year earlier. Prices for food away from home or restaurant prices rose 0.6% in March, and we're 8.8% higher than March 2022. And prices for all food, so both groceries and restaurant prices, rose 0.1% in March, and then we're up 8.5% from March 2022.
USDA economist Megan Schweitzer.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.